Good morning, everyone. My name is Andrew Lockwood, president of Pacific Islands Institute, and I'm happy to be here today to announce the second annual 2018 Community Distinction Awards. The idea of Community Distinction Awards was first proposed by the Executive Advisory Council here 2 years ago during their meeting in Bermuda. This year, we asked you, the community, to nominate your colleagues that are going above and beyond in bold and innovative decisions, educational mission, and connecting travelers with local communities with a community focus in mind. Thank you to all that submitted nominations. Our first award this year is the Bold Move Award. This award recognizes an organization that encourages team members to foster risk-taking, an individual who stuck their neck out and took bold actions to source a solution or implement a new idea. Acknowledging the importance of risk-taking, supporting adaptability, and encouraging creativity is necessary for staying competitive in the marketplace. This year's award is given to Martin Ludwig, Senior Director, Alumni Travel, Georgia Tech Alumni Association. Martin was nominated by Michael Maglione, Senior Director of Business Development, Go Next. The nomination reads, Martin has been an innovator in the manner with which he services his alumni travelers. Martin continues to refine the process by networking with other travel planners to create best practices, a dynamic annual travel reception, and hands-on communication with his travelers. Well done, Martin. Our second award is the Covenant Award. This award recognizes an organization or individual that creates harmony in their design and execution of travel experiences involving and benefiting local communities visited. A people-to-people or immersion tourism program's resilience, uniqueness, and strength relies on caring for, strengthening, and working with local communities. The award is given this year to Karen Kuttner Dimitri, Vice President of Affinity Charter Sales, Lindblad Expeditions. Thank you. Karen was nominated by Beth Ray Schroeder, Director of Duke Alumni Travels, Duke University. The nomination reads, Lindblad Expeditions is dedicated to educating travelers, sailing safely through the world's waters, and being a powerful force for the preservation of places visited. On each departure, their expedition crews are complemented by a team of naturalists, scientists, well-being experts, and photographers who each add to the immense learning experience of every traveler. In addition to their conservation efforts and restoration projects worldwide, Karen, as their stellar representative, has supported Duke's travel program for over a decade in delivering superlative educational expeditions. Thank you, Karen. Our final award this morning is the Educational Award. This award recognizes a well-curated travel program or tours portfolio that consistently delivers the ultimate educational experience by matching educational mission to travel program design and delivery on every aspect of development and execution. Their travel offerings or itineraries reflect substantive lifelong learning through well-curated itinerary developments, authentic in-country experiences, strong faculty and guide involvement, and a keen focus on transformative learning and reflection. The award is given to Rob Fury, Director of Office of Lifelong Learning, Washington and Lee University. Rob was also nominated by Michael Maglione, Senior Director of Business Development, Go Next, and Susie Thompson, Retired Associate Director, Office of Lifelong Learning, Washington and Lee. The nomination reads, Washington and Lee's travel program garners great participation due to its education-centric focus and excellent roster of well-versed faculty that also exhibit strong hosting skills. Additionally, Rob has been recognized all over the country for Washington and Lee's outstanding organization and for the quality of their programs.
Despite the apparent haste of this session, I must take a moment to say thank you. So thank you to the members of the Academy. Thank you also to my mother and father. But I am reminded that if you hang around long enough, they have to give you something. For me, it's been 30 years at the educational travel community. So I suppose this is something of a lifetime achievement award. If there have been any achievements, and this is where the thank you comes in, these achievements have not been solitary. For any success of the educational travel program at Washington and Lee University, I am deeply indebted to the educational travel community, to my fellow planners for their friendship, wisdom, and for their example of best practices, to those who so well represent their destinations, to Amir, to Tarek, to Semi, to Mahmoud, Augustine, and Raoul, to too many I can mention here, and above all, to our tour operators, who absorb most of the risk, if not all of it, who remind us that, yes, there is chaos at the margins that can be managed, who remind us also that there is, well, Murphy's Law that seems to be written into our Constitution, but also that there is a world out there that is both accessible and grand. So I'm especially indebted to Stacy and to Jim, to Karen and Steve, Rita and Tom, Jordan and Mike, and many others too numerous to mention here. I am indeed indebted to our enlightened partners in educational travel who remind us here and out there in the field of our mutual endeavors that in this noble enterprise, we are not alone. So thank you all very much.
I'm sure every newspaper in the world is going to want to carry these photos. So congratulations to all of our nominees. We're thrilled to recognize programs that are going above and beyond in their daily jobs and helping to create excellence in our niche travel industry. At this time, I'd like to invite Bridget St. Clair, Executive Manager of Princeton Journeys, to the stage.
Good morning. Congratulations to the award winners. I am Bridget St. Clair, Executive Manager of Princeton Journeys, and I want to welcome you to the Bold Talk with Nancy Giordano, Framing the Big Shift and What the World Needs from You. As the session description states, we are living in a time that is significant to history as the Renaissance. Do we realize it? This session will place this moment in time in context and inspire us to embrace our unique position to contribute to the future. But before we get started, we have two fantastic sponsors that would like to share with you their services, and I would like to invite you all to visit them at their booths. First, we have MIR, and Doug has asked me to remind you that MIR means peace and world in Russian. Yeah, and we will see a video from them. So Doug and Annie from MIR, thank you for sponsoring. Please visit them at booth number 31.
We'll be right back.
Thank you, Jameer. And we do have a second fantastic sponsor this morning. Chris with Global Rescue is in booth number 30, and they will also now be sharing a short video with you.
I'm Jeff Kaysen. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of the Schools at Middlebury College, and also Middlebury's Chief International Officer. Given the global footprint that we have, I don't think we could do what we do without Global Rescue. It provides the kinds of services that we need, it provides us with the peace of mind that we need, and it really helps us carry out the kind of programs that we really want to have as an institution. When the crisis erupted in Egypt in late January, early February of 2011, we made the decision to evacuate. So we contacted our insurance provider, which had, as an add-on, a security evacuation provider. And we engaged them and said, we want to start. They kind of fumbled. We were having a hard time figuring out exactly what they were going to do with our students. At a certain point in time, they told us that they had picked up our students and were transporting them to the airport. Turns out they weren't. After debating a bit about what to do, we said, it looks like our evacuation provider is not doing what they were supposed to. Let's go with Global Rescue. So once we had actually initiated the arrangement with Global Rescue, within a couple of hours, there were Global Rescue personnel on the ground able to help us out. We had 24 students in Egypt, in Alexandria, and Global Rescue brought that plane in from Prague and then brought our students out to Prague in much more quickly than any other evacuation provider was doing. Because of the experience that we had with Global Rescue in Egypt, we decided to engage them long-term to provide security advisory and medical advisory services for us. Whenever there is any sort of incident that happens abroad, the travelers, the students, the faculty are getting that communication directly to them. So they'll know what to look for. If there's a demonstration someplace, if there's some sort of emergency happening, they'll find out right away. As we've become bigger and more complex, and as we've opened up more programs and are keeping track of what students are doing and faculty are doing around the world, we have found it to be essential to have this kind of service. I don't think we could do what we're doing if we didn't have Global Rescue involved with us.
Thank you, Global Rescue. Again, they're in booth number 30. And now it is my honor to introduce to you Nancy Giordano, who is our Bold Talk speaker this morning. Nancy is a strategic futurist, a corporate strategist, an event catalyst, and known to be endlessly optimistic. Nancy's energy and visionary leadership will get us thinking about the escalating expectations ahead. Nancy is the founder and CEO of Play Big Incorporated, a strategic inspiration company. It is now my honor to introduce Nancy and invite her to come speak to you.
I wanted to keep the theme going and do the Golden Globes thing. We have to walk through all the tables to get to the stage. So I feel like I can. Thank you for the introduction and for the sponsorship. I'm very excited. I went into the showroom yesterday, and the first place I went was to Global Rescue. Ended up having a long chat with Chris. So, and I thought your business is doing really, really well these days since the world is a little crazy. We're going to race through. Abby's going to do a little time check and make sure that I don't go too long. But apparently I may have a little extra time since you guys were quick with your thank yous this morning, which I'm grateful for. It's really the challenging part about giving a talk like this is that there's so much, right? I have to try and figure out what is the most relevant part for this moment today. Fortunately, I will do a CEO Q&A thing later and a workshop later, and I'll be around until tomorrow. So whatever I don't cover, we will have a chance to dive into. But I'm just going to jump in. I describe this as the big shift. This is a quote that many of you have probably heard. William Gibson is famous for having a quote done it, and most people take a picture of it and think this is the guide for the future. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you that I don't think it's true anymore, right? It's just happening too fast. It isn't so much about finding the killer thing and waiting for it to kind of roll into your industry or into your office or into your life, and then being able to execute on it once it's been really proven and tested by everybody else that was on the edge. It's actually happening in real time. So as we start to think about how to build a future that is that fast, really the question is, how do you build a roadmap? Right? How do you build a strategy that makes sense? So we're going to dive into my perspective on that and see what you guys think from your work and your world. I use this as my totem. Right? When I go and do strategic work with anyone or I think about where the world is going, these are the two questions that I spend time answering. What does the future need and expect of us? Well, we'll talk a little bit about that today. Some of it you guys already know, right? But it's just thinking about it and being conscious of it and actually plotting it out that way. And then matching that to what you're in a unique position to create and contribute to it. And that is as a human, that is as a professional, that is in, you know, the industry. Everyone has a unique perspective, a set of resources, a set of perspectives that contribute in a really unique and different way. And whether I'm talking to Nestle or whether I'm talking to a food startup, right, each of them have a very unique position from which it is to disrupt or add value to a particular industry. So this isn't just for small or big, this is for everybody. The other thing I will invite you guys to do is to think about this. I was on the bus here yesterday and someone asked me, like, for whom is this talk? Like, from what perspective? And I answered all three, right? As humans, we're going through this, as people, you know, as parents and as neighbors and as contributors on the planet. We're also doing it as part of our work and we're doing it as members of society, right? There are questions that are going to be hitting us on all levels that we need to have a perspective on. And so, again, I invite you to think about this both broadly and as narrow as you'd like. And here, in a 20-something minutes, we're going to cover where we're now, where we're headed, what does it mean, and how we'll get there. Sound good? Now, graciously, again, Abby gave me a few more minutes, because otherwise I could talk really, really fast and I'd get through it really quickly, but nobody would understand what I was saying. So I'm going to try really hard not to be so quick. But I do get very passionate about this stuff, right? These are really important topics to have, because when we're facing these questions about how to stay relevant and how to add value, we have to think about where we are. So right now, you guys know this, right? Technology is changing, information is growing, culture is shifting exponentially. I have used this slide for many, many years, and I'm telling you, I thought we were at the sigmoidal end 5 years ago, and it's just like even faster. I mean, at some point, it'll have to go off the slide, right? It is so fast. I haven't found the actual stat, but I keep hearing that somehow the amount of information on the planet has doubled in the last just 2 years, right? There's so much that we're trying to get our hands around and make sense of. And this is creating all kinds of interesting shifts, right? One is that we are demanding more quality, innovation, transparency, personalization, speed, certainly for you guys, discovery, security, and peace of mind. I mean, we want more and more and more and more, and we're willing for generally to give less, right? Time, money, energy, complexity, and loyalty. There's one little footnote on this that I started thinking about yesterday that we'll talk about in a moment. But for the most part, I think that this still holds true. And this is the tension that we face, right? Escalating expectations in both directions. I want more and I want to give you less in order for that to be successful. So this is leading to, again, this big shift that we've been talking about for a long time. Every industry, every organization, every person, old systems break down, new ones have yet to be created. Often people fall in that gap in the middle, right? Who are the two companies that we always look at as the big failures that somehow didn't get it together? Blockbuster and Kodak, right? They will forever be the ones that somehow just didn't make it happen. There's also Circuit City. BlackBerry was tenuous for a while. So it is not an easy thing. And the dotted line on the other side means just because you've made it over doesn't mean that you are, you know, permanently there. There is no such thing as guaranteed success. I gave a small version of this talk to Carrefour, which is one of the, you know, second largest retailer in the world, and it had a slide that said brand survival is not guaranteed, and they all took a photo of that slide. And I laughed. I'm like, just because you guys have been around for 125 years does not mean that you get to stick around, right? Things are transforming, and you need to figure out the role that you want to have as it moves forward. And how your perspective on it certainly makes a big difference. There are people who find this very daunting and very overwhelming and very concerning, and a whole list of words that are not very positive. And there are plenty of people who are finding tremendous opportunity, getting, you know, richer every day, and are disrupting and blowing up all kinds of things because new things are possible, right? We've got all kinds of ways of being able to change what we do, and they're seeing the opportunities in that. So, you know, again, I veer to the optimistic. I'm aware of some of the challenges, right? I'm not naive enough to believe that it's all super rosy, but I do think we have agency. We have more power than we think we do to navigate some of this. So this is really the crux of my talk today, this photo. Who sees a picture in it? Right, some but not all. And what do you see?
A giraffe.
Right, and how do we know it's a giraffe, right? It's not a literal picture of a giraffe. It is that you are familiar with the properties of giraffiness. You know, giraffes have certain kinds of ears and certain kinds of snouts and certain kinds of patterns, right? So we are going to take the same approach to the future. I do not have the answer for the future, right? I don't have it clearly to say, do this. Although if we sat down long enough, I could probably come up with a couple of ideas. I'm really trying to give you guys the principles or sort of the attributes of futuriness so that when these opportunities come knocking on your door, you see them, right? Because the key is to be able to recognize it when it's there. Another one of my favorite quotes is that you can't trust your judgment if your imagination is out of focus. Good old Mark Twain. It seems perfect to be here quoting him. But I think that is so critical, right? When you are able to take a broader view, which is so much, again, of what you provide to your customers and your clients, they're able to think more, generously and more provocatively. So where are we headed? This is a map, or this is kind of a structure that I put together years ago and we continuously update. These are sort of the 10 big shifts that we pay attention to. Again, strategically, they are really critical to understand. I do not have time to take you guys through all that stuff. I'm sure some versions of it are online or have a little booklet on it I can send to some that are interested. A little bit of it's outdated, but for the most part, it's still pretty true. And here are the four I am going to quickly go through because I feel like, again, it's important that we share the same grounding on some of this. All right? So the first is bipolar economy. This has got to be, again, hugely important to the work that you guys do, which is the fact that it continues to get more and more extreme on both ends. Right, that number, 35.6%, is the amount of wealth that 1% of Americans own. And I think that number is probably continuing to grow. If you look at it globally, it's even more concentrated. It starts to get kind of scary when you start to see how much wealth is controlled by how few people. Now, if you imagine that the world will be run by algorithms that are owned by very fewer people, do you imagine that that's going to get better or worse? Right? When you think about it, we go from a trucking industry that supports many, many people around the country, not just the truck drivers, but also the hotels and the places that they stay, and we now are going to have autonomous trucks that are owned by a handful of people, right? That's still making money. We're still transporting goods, theoretically, unless we're 3D printing them in our backyards. But the thing is, I believe this is going to get worse before it gets better. I don't know how it won't. So there's a lot of conversations about how we redistribute wealth, because when you look at it like this, right, you start to think, there are people who do not have as much disposable income and are really trying to think through how they have a high quality of life and don't worry so much about, wealth and money, which is sharing economy becomes part of that. All kinds of other sort of innovations become part of that. Interestingly, if you don't know anything about universal basic income, I just encourage you guys to Google it. It is one of the few income redistribution, if you will, or economic kind of shifts that is bipartisan. It has come around through Milton Friedman and Reagan actually were proponents of it back in the day. It is controversial, but it is also being tested in many parts of the world, including in Hawaii and recently now in Stockton in California. These are some of the places around the world where it's being piloted and experimented with. Nobody knows exactly what the right amount is, but the idea is that we would give everyone some sort of basic amount of money on a monthly basis or annual basis to be able to cover necessities. Because as productivity continues to increase, and whether it's through automation or robotics or AI or whatever it is, we're able to churn out the same amount that we were able to churn out, probably with lower costs because energy costs will go down. How does that get spread to a society? So when we talk about being at the front end of the Renaissance, which I thought, gosh, that's really a bold claim to have made, I realized a friend of mine just wrote a book. It's called The Fourth Age. It'll be out in April. And he believes that we're actually, in as fundamental an era of shift as when we invented fire and language, and when we invented agriculture and city-states, and when we invented the wheel, invented the nation-state. Like, we are at that kind of provocative place in history where we are going to have really fundamental shifts in what we think about what society looks like and humanity and how it's taken care of. So my invitation number one is to wonder versus resist. Someone gave me this advice a few years ago in Austin, and I was really grateful for it. It's really hard, apparently, to be in wonder and resistance at the same time. So it doesn't mean that you're gullible, and doesn't mean you say yes, 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 but it does make you say, I wonder if, right, as opposed to immediately, oh, that'll never work, or that, that I tried that, it did never happen. So just, I encourage you to place it in place of wonder. All right, second is disruption mandate. This did not exist before 2007, really hard to imagine, right? There was a study once that said, would you be willing to give up a limb for your phone? And I was like, well, maybe. They've got really cool prostheses now. I'm like, maybe. It is very, very tethered to my hand. I know there's a lot of conversations right now about whether or not youth are too attached to their phones. But the fact is, before the phone existed, I mean, none of these apps and these companies that are worth billions now and the services that they provide existed either. So if you imagine that just in the last 10 or 11 years, what will happen when we have artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, 3D printing, nanotechnology, virtual technology, augmented technology, or augmented reality, the Internet of Things and everything, bioengineering, what I am calling now crypto coordination, which is sort of beyond blockchain, but really thinking about what crypto means, human-machine interfaces, I mean, it goes on and on and on. And it's really, again, about the confluence of these, right? Any one of these will have an impact. When you imagine that these are working in coordination together, it really sets up a what is possible. So I'll just give you a little quick peek into what's happening now. There's a San Francisco startup that worked in collaboration actually with a Russian company to print a whole house in 24 hours. The house costs $10,395, I think. It's supposed to last 175 years. So it is not designed to just be temporary structure. It was a solid structure, it's not very big, but they were driven by this idea of how do we create low-cost housing. If we think again about that income divide, if we start to think about how the future of work and working might shift, they're trying to think about low-cost solutions for housing, and this is one way that they're doing it. Then you've got the whole conversation about what's going on with robots, right? A burger-flipping robot had its first day on the job in California. So what does California start to do? Well, gosh, we should tax robots. You know, for their increased productivity. It's never going to work. We didn't tax Excel spreadsheets when they came in and made our lives easier, right? In some ways, it's just an advance of that. But there's this, like, question about how do we somehow manage for that. First ever legislation on self-driving cars hits the House. That was a few months ago. We all probably heard the news last week or the week before that Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway are starting a healthcare company. Do any of them have healthcare experience? Not as a provider, but certainly as a participant, right, and as an employer who's trying to pay all this stuff out, and as certainly as smart business people who think that the system and the structure is so distorted that they figure, you know, they've got a shot at being able to make it better. And the interesting thing about it is that they're going to pilot it with their employees, which adds up to over 1 million. I think it's 1.5 million of their own employees will get a chance to sort of be part of this system first. And apparently it's something Jeff Bezos has been thinking about a lot. And the one that I found really super fascinating is that Kodak surges after announcing plans to launch a cryptocurrency called Kodak Coin. So Kodak is back. They are not going to be known as the people who never got it out of that side. But it is, again, it sounds crazy, it sounds hypey, it sounds like they're just jumping on a bandwagon, but what they're realizing is crypto technology allows them to be able to do, I don't know if the word is marking, the photography, so that the photographer's work doesn't just get so stolen, I guess for lack of a better word, sort of usurped without getting credit or without getting remuneration. And this kind of cryptocurrency, crypto technology allows that to potentially be fingerprinted differently. So yay for them. And their stock took a thing. I actually tweeted about it when it was 60% up, and I think it went up to 120% or something. It continued to grow. I haven't watched it in the last few days to see if it stayed. But certainly props for them for trying something. Now here's the thing I was thinking about, what is the most impactful one for you guys, right? Different audiences have different technologies that will impact them. I really think virtual reality is a big deal in your world. I'm assuming you guys think so too. Who's actually tried on virtual reality goggles? Wow, lots of you, yay. It depends again on the experience that you have. Sometimes it's really extraordinary, sometimes it's kind of meh. The content is still being developed. But there's a great video that Intel had done where they went into a retirement home in Spain, more low-income home. These women, I think it was all women, and did not come from an upper-class background. They had very kind of simple lives, and they all dreamed that they would have been able to go to Spain, or they would have been able to go to Jerusalem, or some of these places around the world, or see a ballet. I mean, I'd never seen a ballet before. So they put on the virtual reality glasses, and these women are just like, a gobsmacked isn't even the right word. They're so moved. They cry. Now, again, they're sensitive older women. Probably doesn't take that much. At the same time, I mean, it really is someplace that you would never have a chance to go, and now you get the chance to do, right? Or the companies that are doing that as sort of a way of marketing, as sort of a teaser for the location that you get to go to. So my wish would be for you guys not to resist this, but to imagine how you play with this, right? You have extraordinary access to content So maybe not everybody gets to take your trips, you know, in physical form, but imagine you guys being a conduit to being able to give that to folks who would not have another opportunity to do that. Business models are changing and shifting as part of all this. So rethinking what we, where we create value and how we create value is a part of the big invitation. And what you saw for those companies that I just showed you that are doing amazing things, they're really rethinking how they create value and how they monetize it. So then we go to next. Okay, that's just now. Right, that is all happening now. Next, who the heck knows, right? This is a drawing from a patent filing that Amazon did last year, which was for potential delivery drones. Now look at the person is at the bottom. That little doorway is that little person. So imagine the scale of this, right? Now, this is before they bought Whole Foods, so maybe it'll shift. But the idea is how do I get into city centers and are able to deliver even faster? And the job is I would be in this little drone hive giving things to the drone and they'd be delivering it to us instantly. Because again, expectations keep going up. Why should I have to wait a day? Why should I have to wait 6 hours? Why? I want it now. And they're like, okay, we'll figure that out. Whether or not it looks like that or not, the fact is people are spending a lot of time thinking about this, right? I have a son who just turned 21 yesterday, who is an aerospace engineer, and this is the world he wants to go into, is the unmanned aerial vehicles and assessing risk for drones. And as a futurist mom, I'm like, yes, I do think there is career longevity there. Then there's this whole question about what happens with AI or with monitors that are in our homes, right? This was really exciting when people started talking about Alexa and Google Home, and then, gosh, Aristotle was going to create one for kids, and it was going to help soothe babies and help teach them their ABCs and answer their questions about, like, where do babies come from and why is the sky blue? And there was a little question about that. But as it became more clear what this was going to be, parents revolted and begged them to take it off the market. And so Mattel canceled the AI babysitter, right, after 17,000 complaints. So the fact is, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. Right? You got to really think about who you are doing this for and what value you are creating with it, what you do with the data, how invasive it can be. Trust is a really critical part. Again, taking people on the trips that you guys take around the world, I think you guys have a better sense of that than most, but really it is a really critical thing. So when I think about innovation, I think about it's really important that we contribute versus extract. You're seeing now the big backlash with Facebook, right? And the founders of Facebook and even early Google who are like, oh my God, if we'd only known. But the fact is they kind of knew. Right? They did know. They built these algorithms to be very addictive. They built, you know, loopholes for people to be able to exploit them because it was both exciting to do it and I'm sure financially successful to do it. So I do think we're moving past that era now. The CEO of Blackstone just sent a big email out about the importance of purpose and work and thinking about that we come at it from a place of creating value, not just extracting value. So it's a model that I hold very much again in the work. Every single thing on the planet can be made with an intention to create value versus just extract. It's how we source it, it's how we price it, it's how we distribute it, it's how we think about the life cycle at the end of it. There's lots of ways in which we can think about that stuff, but it is, I think, really even more strongly now moving in this direction. So you've got this permanent state of ambiguity, right? There used to be kind of a beginning, a middle, and an end. There were narratives that kind of made sense. There were news stories and news cycles. Like, it is just like a free-for-all at this particular point, which is difficult on our limbic system. We aren't really built for this constant barrage of information and news and decision-making, right? Good old FOMO did not exist, I think, potentially back in the day. Who has seen VUCA and is familiar with VUCA? It was a military term that has been usurped by the business community to talk about kind of the state that we're in, which is how do you plan for an environment that has volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity? Right? It is tough to think about how you manage through that. So different things have risen. Things like design thinking has really been partly a response to this. Again, design thinking requires or deserves a significantly more time. But in a nutshell, it is about approaching things with empathy to really understand what the user really needs. Right? Build something really minimal viable product, test it, get feedback, iterate it, and do it again. So this is no longer about this idea that we research, we perfect, and then we launch. You know, I've worked with a lot of really big food companies that spend millions of dollars doing it that way. They put it into a test in Walmart or Kroger, they get 6 weeks, and if it doesn't work, boom, they're done, and they've invested so much. Now they're really all trying to think about cycles that are faster and being able to go to markets that are smaller. There's also, I will argue, the growing need for compassion, right? I was at a tech conference in Zurich 2 weeks ago called the World Web Forum, And there were, you know, great speakers and all kinds of wonderful talks about where the world was going. The theme, by the way, was the end of nation. There was really this question about when we move beyond the nation state as technology comes and, you know, sort of enters our lives. But then there was a small workshop that was done by the woman from the D School, actually at Stanford, the design thinking school. And she did a workshop on ambiguity. And at the end of this 20 minutes, she had people write postcards about how they felt about ambiguity and walking into this world that feels like this. And there, you know, and people got up and read them. Now, I will just, actually, never mind, I won't say that. But the people who read them were very courageous. So this one woman read hers, and this was it. "Dear Jean-Paul, I've heard some amazing things / developments today at the conference, but I feel lost. I simply do not understand how certain technologies work, and it drives me crazy. Will I ever be able to cope with a highly complicated new world? Love, Sabine." And I just thought, oh my God, she said what everybody is feeling, right? These are highly skilled people that came to this conference. It was an expensive conference. It was, you know, tech executives from around Europe. So these were not, you know, the average, you know, deli manager. I mean, this is not, again, that person is any less clued in. That person obviously sometimes is more clued in. They're probably trading Bitcoin and making more money than all of us. But I just thought it was really interesting to see people be that open and that vulnerable in expressing their overwhelm. And I feel that in everything I do. I'm on a board for a retail association, so I go to these conferences for the retail industry, and I sit down and talk to some of the people at the conference, and the guy who buys cutting boards for a large retailer in the Midwest is just overwhelmed by the number of choices and how fast it all happens, right? He's supposed to be buying these things for millennials. He doesn't really know what millennials super want, and has to be making decisions and can't really fail. And I felt like stress and heart disease building in this person, and wanted to just figure out, how do we create a solution for him? How do we build a better online platform? How do we mix and match things? How do I create an online focus group? Like, I'm trying to think of ways to help him not feel so lost in his work. Because when we can approach it from that perspective, VUCA actually can take a different turn, right? VUCA can be about vision and understanding and collaboration and agility. These are the things that we talk a lot about in business, is how do we move from a place of feeling, again, so overwhelmed to a place in which we feel like we've got some agency and control for no other reason, just for our own physical and mental health. So I love this quote from Otto Scharmer at MIT, which is, "Leadership is about being better able to listen to the whole than anyone else can." One of the big shifts what I didn't get to talk to is about being connected, right? That we are, things are much more connected to one another than we ever see. And if we're able to step back and look at the whole, we're able to see opportunities. We often see it only from our own little pixel, right? And we don't step back and look at the painting. So one of the real opportunities right now is what we call systemic thinking. Thinking about how this is connected to this is connected to this. How income, right, and what we're going to talk about in a moment, another thing called loneliness, is connected to people's desire to go do this and that. So when you're able to look at the system as broadly as your curiosity and imagination can, you're able to see many more opportunities. And again, it doesn't feel so overwhelming. So my invitation here is to shift our orientation from replicating the success of the past to navigating the innovation of the future. Right? Being a navigator is really different than being a replicator. Most of us in this room are of a certain age where we were taught how to do it. They were kind of, you know, we developed the playbook. We did our Six Sigma and our TQM and all this stuff to be able to be more and more efficient in what we did. And we were just going to scale it then around the world. And then everything shifted and changed. And it is no longer about having those skills of replicating. It's really about developing a capacity for navigating. That's about curiosity. That's about humility. That's about being confident and testing some things. It's about building collaborative networks. There's a whole thing that goes with being a navigator that's different than being a replicator. Does that make sense? And the last is a human cloud, which again, you are smack dab as part of the ecosystem of, which is the fact that we are not alone in doing this. I love that was the closing line of the acceptance speech before. This idea really came from, I was sitting on a panel with the CEO of a tech company and with the head of cloud computing for Microsoft and a person from Australia that I was introduced to as a bookmaker. And I thought, oh my God, a bookmaker. No, he does biggest betting company in Australia. and there, by the way, it's a legal industry, and so they can bet on like the heart rate of a player, the speed of the ball, the, you know, how many clouds are going to be in the sky that day. I mean, it is stunning what they have built an industry around micro betting. But we're having this whole conversation, and Bob Kelly from Microsoft is talking about the fact that the cloud, the digital cloud, has been the enabler for such a technological leap. It allows for this collection of all this data, which allows for AI to do its thing, which allows all this like giant leap in technology. And I said out loud to that room, well, what is the equivalent of the human cloud? How are we keeping up with the pace of this technology, right? What are we doing in order for that to work? So Here's the reality. We're not doing it very well. The age of loneliness is killing us. Social isolation is a potent cause of early death. As smoking 15 cigarettes a day, loneliness is twice as deadly as obesity, as the former Surgeon General really felt strongly about this. And what's interesting is not just on a societal level. Like, we can look at this and say there are aging seniors, there are single-person households, there are the dislocation of work, right? We don't have big work communities anymore. We don't necessarily have religious communities anymore. We're moving away from our families. It's really cool to be in the gig economy, but the gig economy means that I don't get a chance to go to the same office every day and get to be part of a training program and be part of a cohort of, you know, my peers. So there's a lot of reasons that contribute to this, but what's interesting is it's not just happening individually, it's also happening in work structures. At work, loneliness reduces task performance, limits creativity, impairs other aspects of executive function, such as reasoning and decision making. There's a Harvard Business piece that was just done about loneliness at work. Why? Because people are feeling like they have to learn everything by themselves and can't share with their peers or taking on new tasks. Things are happening so quickly. There often isn't software or any kind of, platform inside organizations to be able to manage workflow really effectively for people. So they feel kind of either not sure what the task is or what somebody else is doing that's contributing to the task, and they feel like they can't ask anybody. So there is this increasing sense of feeling isolated, which is not good. Right? Now, the good news is you guys are providing at least a portal to connection, right? Yes, I can put on my VR goggles and sit in my house and take a trip to Jerusalem, but it's not the same as certainly getting on a bus or getting on a plane or walking through the town with others and learning about their lives and their history. I will also say people are just feeling overwhelmed for other reasons. This is just quickly. These are news alerts that keep coming on my phone. And the reason I keep them on my phone is because my teenagers refuse to take them off their phone. So I feel like I want to see what they're seeing. So this is what my kids get to see. Awesome, right? At least 12 nations have been hit by a huge cyber attack. More than 45,000 ransomware attacks have hit. The fact that deaths of despair from alcohol, drugs, and suicide are raising mortality rates for white Americans. And just when you think it is only the downtrodden that are facing this, let me just tell you that the top 1% is preparing for the apocalypse by buying shares in really luxury bunkers. They have wine cellars and sort of some fake light to make it look like, you know, we're not all underground trying to survive. I was talking to somebody about a food company. They're doing dehydrated food, and one of their big markets is preppers. I didn't realize preppers were actually a target group now, but people who are prepping for the apocalypse. There's a large group of people that are preppers now that have, or for earthquake, or for financial collapse, or for whatever we think might happen. So there are people who are literally sitting around thinking about this and worrying about this. So if they're holding that kind of weight, right? The question is, how do we feel safer? And part of it is that we're moving more and more to communities. These things like WeWork or co-working spaces. WeWork is a really amazing example of having built a brand, not just a solution, but having built a real community around the world when you join WeWork, whether you're a startup or any kind of a small business person. Even small companies. When we started our artificial intelligence company, we were working out of WeWork. You know, and when we moved into our own offices, it felt a little weird, like we were disconnected. Interestingly, they're moving now also into WeLive. So these are now, you know, intentional communities in which people gather together. They have smaller footprint apartments, more social area, and share kind of lifestyle. This is happening in lots of different forms. So intentional housing, intentional communities are continuing to increase, which I think is great. It makes me really happy and might be where I end up someday. And then just on a small thing, you know, Olive Garden has now created a community table. I don't know if it's in all of their restaurants. I'm not sure how all of it is. Part of it's catering to millennials. And it's a combination of you are not lonely and you get to discover some of the new menu items. We'll you know, give you a little extra that nobody else gets by coming and sitting at this table. But I work with a really large food company. We had this conversation years ago, and they thought I was crazy, right? We talked about community being a really, really important aspect of the community, of the casual dining segment of the market. That's one of the things that they really offer, is that you go with your family, you go with your coworkers, and if you don't have them, do you feel left out? Well, gosh, it'd be fun if I could find some there. So anybody that's facilitating, you know, sort of the connection and matchmaking with others, I think is really winning because, again, as was just stated before, we are better when we are connected versus alone, right? You're able to take more confident decisions, you're able to feel much more resilient, you're able to feel well-held. There's a whole bunch of things that come from this. So to the extent that we can help facilitate that, I think it's critical. All right, so what does all this mean, right? If you're trying to navigate now between these big shifts and these big technologies, what I have often found with the organizations that I've gone in to help, as large as they can be, like I did a big project with the Coca-Cola company on how to prevent global juice sales from collapsing in the weight of sugar backlash, right, which is one of my favorite projects, actually. Because I love sugar. Not a big soda fan, big juice fan. Don't love sugar, love juice, sorry. clarify. I'm a big Juice fan. And, you know, we had experts that came in. I did, you know, beautiful PowerPoint slides. I really felt like we had the answer. And at the end of the day, if you do not have a culture that's able to absorb and respond to that new information, it does not matter how great the consulting advice is, right? It doesn't matter how, you know, lively my presentation will be. You have to have an orientation to want to open to new. One of the talks I heard in Zurich was from David Treese from Berkeley, who I didn't realize for years has been writing about dynamic capabilities. If y'all want to Google that, I Googled that a little bit last night. It was too much to try and throw into this presentation, but he really does talk about building a mindset for adaptivity. Because here we are, we can either like panic that, you know, our, you know, artificial intelligence and all these things are going to take over the world and we're all going to be lost, or we can have this whole conversation about AI is going to, you know, help us solve problems that we were never able to solve before. I think it's the key to the end of cancer and many other things. I think it'll help us predict earthquakes. It'll be extraordinary. But we're locked in this really, really big, huge conversation when I think that there's one that's actually closer to home, which is the majority of companies, their employees and their leaders navigate a space where competitors appear overnight. Customers demand innovations monthly, business plans rarely last a full year, and career ladders have been replaced by trampolines. This environment of constant change will only accelerate in the future, and traditional business leaders are ill-equipped to deal with it. I think he may be talking about us, right? How do we ensure that that isn't us? How do we develop, again, some capacities for being able to manage this? And there's these wonderful books that say things like disrupt yourself. I think Whitney Johnson is very, very bright and very passionate and very compassionate, right? She wants to make sure that we're individually prepared for this. But as I listen to podcast after podcast or read certain articles, or even when I was at the World Web Forum, the conversations about people aren't changing fast enough. People aren't adapting fast enough. People don't get it. And I think it is literally more than that. It is not just about us as individuals. Right? It is about the systems of which we are a part. And so I wrote something on New Year's, an essay about the embracing the dance between dark and light. So I laughed that I quoted myself. But the reality is, I really do believe that we all deserve to be better held by each other, right? By the systems that we design and by the technologies that we advance. So the systems we design show that we often have expectations for folks that are not aligned with incentives. We say we want this, but we actually incentivize that, either financially or socially. Right? So we say we, you know, curiosity is really important, innovation is really important, but when I ask to go to a conference that's kind of on the edge, people go, why you want to go that? That's professional. That's personal development, not professional development, right? I'm like, no, man, it's expanding my curiosity. It's allowing me to meet people that, you know, we might want to collaborate with on a project down the road, but people get very narrow then about it and think, no, we can't do that. So think about when you're asking your teams or yourself to grow, are those incentives aligned? Is the infrastructure, you know, working to your benefit? I've often been in companies that, again, beg for collaboration and beg for more agile ways of working, and then they run big, huge, high cubes and nobody can see each other, right? And then when you say, okay, well, have you guys tried an open office plan? It was like, yes, we tried that and it failed. Everyone got freaked out about it. I'm like, okay, well, they didn't understand the context. You didn't give them time to adjust, right? You didn't explain to them how this will make their work better and it will hold them. You gotta give people time. You gotta hold people through change, right? You can't just like throw it in there, it didn't work, bail out. But you have to think about how. One of the talks, again, that I heard in Zurich was about navigating between empathy and responsibility. I love that idea, right? We do need to be empathetic, but we still need to make sure we're marching forward. So that's, to me, leadering versus leadership. Leadership is a concept where we kind of outsource it to the people at the top and figure they'll have all the decisions and they'll make it all better. And the reality is each of us are in a position every day to make choices that empower, you know, our team, that empower our customers, that somehow lead to learning a little bit more, trying something a little bit differently, shifting something, being able to open capacity. So the invitation is that it's for all of us. So in closing, how will we get there? All right, I started with these two questions, right? I really do believe this is where it starts. It's about understanding what the future needs and expects. We have a little bit more of a sense of that over the last 20 minutes, right? And it's not, again, that I presented probably anything that you didn't already know, but it's about looking at it in a collective. It's about putting all that in one basket and sorting through it together. And I do think we need to answer that question about what we're in a unique position to create and contribute toward it. So looking at the big shifts, and then thinking about, you know, how we approach our work. So the first piece of advice is from the Harvard Business Review. To change your strategy, first change how you think, right? We want to go in and change strategic stuff, but we have to go back to what Mark Twain invited us to do. About thinking about things more broadly. So this is sort of my playbook handbook, right? Wonder versus resist, create value versus extract, navigate and innovate versus thinking about replicating at scale, build platforms and opportunities for connection to keep us from feeling so alone, and reach out to others by the way, be part of that connecting. And this is, again, why events like this are so extraordinary. And I say this as an introvert. Like, I'm the person who doesn't necessarily go to the party, right, and doesn't reach out to somebody in the, you know, in the bar, but we all could get better at it. Or if you see the introvert, go say hi to them, right? It turns out it's about 50-50, so we need y'all. I'm not kidding. And leadering versus leadership. I will also just say, please take good care of yourself and be compassionate with yourself and others. There is a reason that meditation continues to grow, right? Corporate meditation, individual meditation. It's interesting that as things get more complex and fast, there's a sense of going more and more internal and calming down and quieting and remembering that we are enough, right? And being compassionate with our coworkers or our clients. And, you know, you get a customer on the phone who's freaked out. To the extent that you can hold them well and not kind of freak back out at them, that is better. And you guys have seen recently, Sarah Silverman, the comedian, who I have mixed feelings about. I think her work is kind of crude, so I'm not always a big Sarah fan. But, you know, she did something on Twitter. I don't even know what she wrote. She got trolled by somebody who wrote, you know, an awful four-letter word back to her. And rather than responding or even ignoring, she actually went through and read, or responding out of defensiveness, she read through his timeline. She wrote a very compassionate note back to him, right? And he just completely shifted and opened and apologized and mentioned that he had a really bad back injury and he wasn't able to work and he didn't feel like he had any support and he felt like he'd been really left out and left behind. She, you know, kept engaging with him. She then asked the Twitterverse if someone could get him an MRI and that she would pay for his medical cost. I get chills when I think about it. He went to, you know, a facility in San Antonio, got tested, had 5 fractured vertebra in his back. I know, I started to cry. And she took care of all of that and helped him get a move. We don't know what's going on for people. We just assume it's all okay, right? There's a letter, there's a wonderful TED Talk called A Letter to Those Who Have Lost in This Era. I again encourage you guys, if you want to feel a moment of compassion, to read, to watch that. It's a 16-minute talk done by Anand. I don't know his last name, but you can just Google it quickly. A Letter to Those Who've Lost in This Era. It makes you just think again about this idea. And that's why I wrote again on New Year's about the dance between dark and light. It does not mean that we should not pursue progress. I am all about progress. But it is naive for us to imagine that those who currently hold power in a certain way are not going to uprise and want to continue holding it. So how do we manage for that, right? And it is also naive to believe that progress is everyone's a winner when we progress. Not everybody is. Right? So how do we ensure the safest transition for everybody? And with that, I just close and say, your playing small doesn't serve the world. This is what inspired the name of my company. It inspires my work. And I believe in everything that you guys are up to. So thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you so much. I love that she said that the answer to the technology-driven individual age is connecting people, because we create tribes here and we connect each other to our tribes. And if that's a solution, then we're moving in the right direction. So thank you for that. And thank you again for our sponsors, MIR and Global Rescue. Please visit them. MIR's in booth 31 and Global Rescue's in booth number 30. And now we have a few bits and pieces of housekeeping to go over. This room is being kind of reconfigured, so we're asking everyone to move out into the hall as the sessions get set up. And if you are registered for either the Family or Photography Learning Lab, please meet in the front lobby promptly at 10:15 to board your bus. And please remember that you need your registration ticket. If you're registered for Nancy's Intensive in Gardenia 1 or the Risk Management Intensive in Gardenia 2, please have your intensive ticket in hand and enter the session. And again, you need to, even if it's in this room, you need to go out in the foyer first. All intensive sessions have an attendance cap that is optimal for the workshop format. To enter either of these intensive, 2 lines will form outside the session door. Those with tickets queue into the line with the sign that says ticketed registrants for risk management. Those who did not register for the session, join the line that says waitlist. And if there are no shows, space will still be available. It will open up for you to join. And there are 2 power-packed hot topic sessions following now as well. The air industry update in the Bermudiana room and the email marketing in Gardenia 3. These are not ticketed, so everyone is welcome to attend. And as we need to prepare the ballroom for these three sessions, we need you to clear the room and exit to the back and mix and mingle in the foyer. Thank you, everyone.